The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the September 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin with the sports department. Still serving, Jane Pryor made a name for herself as a pro tennis player, then went on to do meaningful nonprofit work, by A.J. Carr. As a player and coach, Jane Pryor completed her Hall of Fame tennis career in 1991, but she's never stopped serving. When Pryor wasn't much taller than a wooden racket, her mother, Emily Harris Pryor, made sure she and four siblings were on Greensboro's public park tennis courts. It was those early lessons from her mother and later training from teaching pro Dean Mathias that helped propel Pryor on her skyward tennis trajectory. "I got her late, and she was already good," said Mathias, a former Wake Forest and Atlantic Coast Conference doubles champion. "She just needed confidence, a little direction, and condition." It wasn't until after playing basketball and tennis her freshman year at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill that she refocused solely on her first love. Tennis was, after all, the ticket to a pro circuit packed with stars like Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. At UNC, Pryor won four state junior titles, three doubles, one single. She earned All-America honors and was team captain while also a Phi Beta Kappa student. After college, she turned pro and gained a number 42 world ranking over 6 years on the tour, boldly competing in all the Grand Slams and smaller tournaments around the world. It was both an arduous and gratifying odyssey. Highlights included wins over four top 10 ranked opponents, reaching the round of 16 at Wimbledon, and pushing icon Billie Jean King to three sets before losing in the Australian Open. But her finest hour unfolded in Perth, Australia, where Pryor upset her sports idol, 14-time Grand Slam champion Yvonne Goolagong, in front of a raucous Aussie crowd. "Do not hit to her backhand and attack all the time," Mathias had advised. With a solid serve, judiciously placed approach shots, and crisp volleys, Pryor implemented the Mathias game plan and won 6-3, 6-3 over one of her heroes. Among her exuberant followers, none were more euphoric than her mother, who posted a sign in the front yard that read, "Ding dong, Jane beat Goolagong." There were other celebratory moments, such as when she and her mother teamed up and earned second place in a national mother-daughter tournament. The runner-up trophy, a silver tennis ball, sits on Pryor's office desk today. Highs and lows were part of the tennis journey. "Losing to Barbara Potter in the fourth round at Wimbledon still haunts me," Pryor says. A loss to precocious 14-year-old Tracy Austin was another stinging setback. But whatever the outcome, Pryor maintained equanimity. Humble in victory, gracious in defeat. "Jane is the epitome of sportsmanship and character," says USTA official Debbie Southern. "She never put winning over integrity." When her pro career was short-circuited by an elbow injury, Pryor transitioned from coaching into coaching and guided Greensboro's Page High School to a state title in her only year directing the team. Then, much to the chagrin of UNC fans, she moved on to Duke University. Going from Carolina stardom to rescue the Tar Heels' biggest rival was tough, but she was resolute in transforming the Duke program to championship status. With scholarship support from then-athletic director Tom Butters, she recruited better players, created spirited team unity, coached with expertise, dominated the Atlantic Coast Conference, and beat Carolina in every head-to-head match. She built a powerhouse women's tennis program, going on to win 4 conference championships, 4 Coach of the Year awards, and posting a 120-45 record in 6 seasons. Today, she stands tall in 3 halls of fame, North Carolina, Southern Tennis, and the Guilford County Hall of Fame. Pryor also received the esteemed USTA and Intercollegiate Tennis Association Community Service Award, presented by former champions Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith during the 1990 U.S. Open. After coaching, Pryor made the change to a long, impactful career with nonprofits. As Southeast Director of the Environmental Defense Fund, she was instrumental in getting much-needed laws passed on pollution reduction, renewable energy, and preferable paper usage. As a volunteer in healthcare, she saw how desperately families needed insurance and was passionate about getting coverage for them. Over time, she served on boards for the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits, Children's Home Society of North Carolina, and UNC Chapel Hill Institute for the Humanities. In 2005, Pryor and her siblings started the Emily Harris Pryor Family Endowment at the North Carolina Tennis Foundation in honor of their mother. The nonprofit provides educational and sports opportunities for youth needing financial support. Today, Pryor still avidly watches tennis, plays a little golf, and likes to go hiking. She stays busy with board positions on the National Health Law Program, EarthShare North Carolina, and Environmental Defense Fund, and worships at First Presbyterian Church in Chapel Hill. Still active and still serving at age 71. This article was edited for Time. Next, A Family Affair with Native Plants in Beech Grove by Helen Yost. The garden of Jay and Kim Yurch's is lush and welcoming, nestled into the quiet North Raleigh neighborhood of Hawthorne. As one looks around, it becomes apparent that gifted plant people live there. Kim grew up in a family of serious gardeners, starting with her parents, who had a small vegetable garden, a strawberry patch, and raspberries that she would help harvest and weed. Her father had grown up on a farm, and each summer Kim spent a week or more with her grandparents. They had a huge garden with perfect alternating rows of vegetables and flowering bulbs, she says. I remember picking green beans, shelling peas, and husking corn. One fall, Kim's grandfather sent her home with paper bags filled with bulbs to plant the next spring, including dahlias, cannas, and gladiolus. He told me how to store them and when to plant them, she says. From that point, Kim was hooked on growing flowers, zinnias from seed, along with other annuals, and the bulbs, which she dug up and stored every fall until she went to college. Jay didn't garden growing up, but his family did. My mom grew tomatoes and zinnias, and my maternal grandfather had an ornamental garden of shrubs, small trees, and perennials. After Kim and Jay married, they bought their first home in Raleigh, a new house on a small lot. It was mostly grass, with a few builder-planted, fast-growing trees, like river birches and red maples, says Jay. They knew they had much to learn about gardening, so they joined the Friends of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum and attended lectures. Through that programming, they learned garden techniques and which plants would do well. With that knowledge, Jay and Kim added Deodar cedar, tea olive, and thorny Eleagnus, screening along the edges of the yard, then filled it in with small trees like eastern redbud, Kusa dogwood, and Japanese snowbell. In a wet area in the back, they planted Japanese iris and other moisture-loving perennials like cardinal flower. The couple bought the land for their current home in the spring of 1995. As soon as they removed a few trees, its name was revealed, Beech Grove, as the land was dominated by American beech. They started construction on their home 5 years later, and they've lived there since 2001. From the start, Kim says, we had a goal of ensuring there's something blooming year-round, both for me and the pollinators. Jay helped with the research, and the two found that fall through the winter was the most challenging. But then we managed to fill those months with japonica camellias, witch hazels, hellebores, and late flowering bulbs like daffodils and summer snowflakes, says Kim. She especially loves making perennial gardens, filled with a tapestry of foliage and flower colors, finding the caladiums and coleus in particular add an array of colors to their shade garden. They also make me think of my grandfather, because I'm still digging up bulbs every fall and storing them, she says. The Yurches have also taken advantage of changes to their land that were outside their control. In 2021, they had several large trees go down behind the house, both on the highest bluff and on the floodplain. We suddenly had more light in those areas than we'd ever had before. But because of the deer herd pressures, there were no tree seedlings to take their place, Jay says. The fallen trees became an opportunity. Because of the property's unique topography and our love of native trees, we had the chance to recreate plant communities from the coastal plain and mountain regions of North Carolina and have them thrive in the conditions, says Jay. But they would also look like they belonged, with mountain species growing on steep slopes among boulders and coastal species growing on a moist creekside floodplain. Some of the species planted in the mountain section are cucumber and Fraser's magnolias, chestnut oak, yellow buckeye, and sugar maple, among others. In the floodplain are sweet bay magnolia, swamp chestnut oak, bald cypress, and overcup oak, as well as shellbark hickory and needle palm. Finding native trees and shrubs can be challenging, especially rare ones like those in Beech Grove, but they've had success with Homewood Nursery and Garden Center in North Raleigh and Garden Treasures Nursery in Wendell. Now the two are experienced gardeners with advice to pass on to others. Jay says that for a larger property like Beech Grove, focus on one area at a time, so it's easy to keep up with supplemental watering for newly planted trees and shrubs until they're established. And don't get discouraged when something dies, says Kim. I've heard so many people say they can't grow anything, but we've had many plants die. You just keep experimenting, and eventually you'll find the things that thrive in your garden with the amount of care you can provide. Today, Beech Grove is a destination garden for plant enthusiasts, garden clubs, and conservationists. The Yurch Garden is always such a delight to visit, says Mark Wethington, director of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum. From the lush plantings surrounding the house to the native habitats along the bottom of the property, a new treasure awaits around every corner and in every season. This article was edited for Time. Next up, Glass Act. David Tingen reflects on 7 decades of bottle collecting by Jarrett Ben Meter. The spot was a decades-old dumping site, generally ignored by adults. A roughly 8-foot embankment sloped down to the creek's edge, where a swing served as the de facto welcome sign for neighborhood kids. On this day, like so many others in that summer of 1955, David Tingen pedaled his secondhand Schwinn bicycle 4 blocks from his home in Oakwood to the creek. His bike basket installed to hold copies of the Raleigh Times during his afternoon paper route now carried a hand-carved miniature boat and a shovel. Upon arrival, he set to work on creating a dam so he could float his boat. He dug into the gradient. Scoop, dump. Scoop, dump. Scoop, tink. Several glass bottles tumbled from the slope like busted teeth. The colors gleamed blue, green, and amber under the sun. Tingen picked up the brightest one. It was about 3 inches tall, deep cobalt. He squinted to read the embossed lettering, Emerson Drug Company, Baltimore. It was beautiful. He wanted to know its story, and in time he would learn that it was a Bromo-Seltzer bottle produced roughly 45 years earlier. Its blue color was standard at the time for distinguishing medicinal contents. The bottle is worth roughly $5 by today's standards, but to the young collector, it was as good as gold. He pocketed the bottle, and a lifelong passion was born. 70 years later, Tingen is on the other side of a prolific life of bottle collecting that includes 50 years as an officer for the Raleigh Bottle Club, 20 as president, and authoring 4 small-run collector's guides. He is considered a preeminent expert on the history of bottling in the state of North Carolina, if not the Southeast. Bottle collecting has given him a network of friends, an appreciating asset and framework for history. But the best part, he says, is still the thrill of holding a find in his hand. It has something real about it, something touchable, something you can look at, put on the shelf, study, and learn about, he says. The early days consisted of digging and rummaging around Raleigh. In addition to the creek, favorite spots included the old waterworks in South Raleigh and the old Carolee Mills. As he unearthed bottles, he took them home, loaded them into crates, and stuck them beneath his family's house, plucking his favorites to line the sills of his bedroom. A lull came as he entered early adulthood. He served in the Navy, studied at Hardberger Business College and Wake Technical Community College, then settled into a career as an electronics field sales engineer. He started a family and moved to North Raleigh. When he did ultimately return to collecting, he followed his curiosity in pursuit of Raleigh bottles, then North Carolina bottles, then pre-Prohibition beer bottles. His collection swelled to well over 1,000. As was the case with the first blue bottle, he wanted to know about each of them. Before the internet was around, he spent countless hours in the Olivia Rainey Library and the State Archives scouring microfilm for the information that he would ultimately compile for his books. Now 82 years old, Tingen has downsized his collection to about 350 keepers in recent years, selling the bulk and giving many of his finest to his children. His ambition these days is to be a resource for what he calls a growing number of North Carolina collectors. He assists friends and strangers alike with research, buying, and selling. Randy Cobb, one of the friends who has benefited from Tingen's passion, lives in Macclesfield and started collecting in the late 1990s. He first met Tingen at a 2010 Greensboro bottle show. At Tingen's behest, Cobb started attending Raleigh Bottle Club meetings, and the two would eventually serve as club officers together. Over the years, they've made exchanges, helped each other with various searches, and become friends. Cobb says what makes Tingen stand apart is his authentic curiosity about the history of each bottle. He has a good memory, and he has stories, says Cobb. He can show you a bottle and tell you exactly where it came from, if he found it or if he bought it. Bottle collecting has changed in the 70 years since Tingen first started. The advent of the Internet lessened research workloads and broadened networks. Tingen has fully embraced the modern resources, but he says no matter his age, the harder the hunt, the more thrilling the find. You go out and look through an old dump or a creek bed or a cistern or outhouse that's 100 years old. To a bottle collector, it's a treasure hunt, he says. Among the vestigial bottles perched in a wall-mounted display case in his home is the very first cobalt blue Emerson bottle, a reminder of the days of roaming around town with nothing but volition and a shovel. I've always believed that you succeed by being a student of whatever you pursue, and it has been fun for me, says Tingen. This article was edited for Time. From the endnote, Wood Charmers, a quirky sculpture in Moore Square, pays tribute to Raleigh's urban wildlife, by Anne Monique Clark. It's a little thrill to see as you're walking through Moore Square, a pair of eyes peeking out from a hollow of a tree, a hawk and an owl nearby. They're close enough to touch, but unafraid of visitors, mainly because they're carved out of wood. The wood was a centuries-old white oak tree on the grounds that had to come down. It's sort of an homage to the tree, giving it a second life, says Moore Square director David Gill. We wanted something that would speak to the wildlife in the park. The number carved in its trunk, 1792, represents the year the park was founded. They enlisted sculptor Corey Lancaster to make the piece. You may have seen his work in other places. His squirrel held court in Nash Square from 2019 until earlier this year, when it was retired due to decay. And he's made sculptures for other places, including Durant Nature Preserve and Pullen and Roanoke Parks. It's pretty special getting to carve a sculpture for a place like Pullen Park, where I used to play in the sandbox, he says. Lancaster is self-taught, one of the few in this area who does this kind of work. His first foray into the art came around 2007 at the urging of his grandfather. He bought me a chainsaw and asked me to make some mushrooms for his yard, Lancaster says. He enjoyed doing it more than he enjoyed his job running a restaurant, and soon his side hustle turned into full-time work. His first ever commission was for a beach house. The client wanted him to carve a pair of flip-flops out of a big cedar log. I thought, I think I can handle this, he laughs. He now gets a lot of commissions for noble animals like eagles and bears. But personally, he likes to play with more, quote, out-of-the-box stuff, like dragons or comic book characters. When clients bring him a large log or tree trunk to carve, Lancaster will start by cutting it in half or quarters, trying to get a strong piece and preserve the ring structure. He's learned what to avoid, including seams down the middle of two-lobed trees, which might make for a weak base, or bits of metal like old nails or hooks from someone using it for a sign or a hammock decades ago. Especially with these 100-year-old trees that have been in someone's yard or a city park, there's no telling what's going to be in them, he says. Lancaster usually uses about 4 chainsaws of various sizes to complete a project, from a large one to block out the rough shape, to smaller ones for deeper, detailed work. During the summer, Lancaster is a fixture at fairs across the country, doing speed carving shows. In the fall, you might find him at harvest festivals or pumpkin patches, like the Phillips Farms in Cary. He usually saves his sculpting projects for the winter, when it's more comfortable to work outside, and he has more time in his schedule. There are plenty of reasons to visit Moore Square over the next few months. Jazz in the Square and Movies on the Lawn continue through September. Lucky Tree Cafe recently opened, and there's a holiday market in the works. When you do visit, say hi to these friendly critters. From the September calendar, September 20th, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., Raleigh's International Festival. Travel the globe for a day at this free one-day international shopping and eating celebration at the North Carolina State Fairgrounds. Enjoy live performances from dancing to singing. Sample a range of different dishes, from sweet Italian gelato to spicy Jamaican jerk chicken. And peruse the bazaar, where you'll find vendors selling jewelry, art, clothing, housewares, pantry items, and more from all over the world. Visit theinternationalfestival.org for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.